This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hang on. The sun's up and it's not Friday.
It's early. Damn early.
Must mean that you're on community radio 3CR for Saturday kick-ons with Jacob and Mercedes.
Hi there.
Oh, the pillars of society cruise down the road each day. They got the economic wherewithal we can't afford to pay.
If Friday night's rave wasn't enough for you, we've got an hour-long summer special where you can listen to us for the next hour from 9 till 10 a.m.
There's a hierarchy of dominance with a power at the top. And if you think you found the magic key, you find they changed the locks. Them pillars of society drive us like a tool. For them, that's cool.
So if you're a regular Asia Pacific Currents listener, you know who we are. Stay tuned. Do not adjust your radio or your clock or even your concept of time for that matter. Yes, it's 9 o'clock on Saturday morning here on Community Radio 3CR. But this is not Asia Pacific Currents, nor is it Palestine Remembered in half an hour's time. But we are filling in for them as they take a whirlwind break over summer. And while we still are Jacob and Mercedes, it's not 5 o'clock on Friday, so it's obviously not a Friday rave. Welcome to the crazy world of 3CR summer programming, where time and tide are fluid, but our politics remain unaltered.
Yeah, that's right. So over the next few weeks, we're going to be presenting some hour-long episodes of a Friday Rave's Saturday Kick-Ons, where we'll have a chance to get a bit deeper into some of the concepts that we'd normally raise on a Friday evening show, but we really don't have enough time to dig as deep just as much as we'd like. So our first crack, we've often spoken about the hidden hand of the capitalists that control government policy in the form of so-called think tanks and PR firms and, of course, what's become known as the revolving door phenomena, where evil villain henchmen move seamlessly between government, military and corporate roles depending on where global capital determines that they'd be best placed to serve the interests of the ruling class in their goals of accumulating more and more of the planet's resources into fewer and fewer hands.
Well, so regular listeners to a Friday rave may recall our special on the 50th anniversary of the coup against the Australian Labor Government in 1975, where we mentioned the fact that while everyone now accepts that the US is concerned about a left-wing government in Australia affecting places like Pine Gap, amongst other things, while they were at the very least a significant contributing factor in the coup, people still spoke about Nixon. Well, he was long gone by November 75, and Gerald Ford was actually president. Well, he seems to have slipped under the radar somewhat. And we mention this now because he was there at the beginning of what has become a network of influential policy organisations that had defined the way undue influence has eroded the democratic processes, such as they were, not just in the US, but in places, well, like here. It's hard to determine where it all began, but you've got to start somewhere.
To kick off our first Saturday kick-ons, we're joined today by a friend of a Friday Raves and of ours personally, Scott Ludlam. Welcome back to 3CR, Scott.
It's nice to be back. Good morning.
So, Scott, tell us, who was Lewis Powell?
Are we just going to dive straight into
it? We'll dive straight into it, mate, into the murky depths of whoever these people are. And why am I looking at a photo of him shaking hands with Gerald Ford?
So, Lewis Powell, he's a great place to start, actually, because it's very difficult to understand the operations of this influence network in Australia without looking to the United States and without taking ourselves a little distance back in time. So Lewis Powell was a very senior American jurist. He was a tobacco lawyer and lobbyist, and he was also, I believe, an informant for the FBI during the Red Scare in the United States. But come the 70s, he was extremely alarmed at the enormous social unrest that was occurring in the United States in the 60s and 70s. So if you think back to that time, a bit before my time, but an incredibly formative period, really, around the world. In the US, you've got effectively race riots, the civil rights movement, anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, feminism is beginning to peak, the nascent environment movement.
Feminism?
Has been published.
not feminism.
All of these things really converging, and large numbers of undercurrents, big student demonstrations in American colleges, is all going on, and so the oligarchs are extremely unimpressed by this because capitalism itself is coming under sustained critique for the harm that it's causing people on the planet. And I think what snapped this guy, Lewis Powell, this tobacco guy, is a piece on Ralph Nader, who had really pissed off the oil companies and the oil industry, because at the time he was campaigning for the importance of having seatbelts in cars. And he wrote a very important and influential manifesto, which came to be known as the Powell Memorandum, in 1971, and handed it off to a mate of his at the American Chamber of Commerce and Industry. And what it effectively laid out was a very concise, plain English plan for the oligarchs to take power back. And in a very real sense, what Powell wrote, which the Chamber of Commerce and Industry in the US set up a bunch of committees and basically put it into effect, he envisaged the world that we live in today, where capitalists are more important than governments, where we live under a perpetual form of state capture, where everything is suddenly ferociously expensive, life itself, every element of our lives has been commodified, everything from health to education to, the experiences of our relationships being mined on social media. That world was envisaged, and he wrote a very stark manifesto on how to achieve it. And so starting to unpick it, I guess it is worth going back to the source of how these guys built the kind of world that we're inhabiting today.
When I first come across the Powell Memorandum, it actually sounded to me like he was a lefty taking the piss, quite frankly, about what was happening. But he touched on that the left were taking over our universities, that we're taking over our judiciary, and we needed to take back the universities, we needed to take back the judiciary, we needed to take back government, we needed to take back... Well, he was talking as if capitalism was on the back foot losing a war against the greenies, lefties and peaceniks.
It does read that way, and that the whole thing's constructed in very highly militarized language as well. Sets out, he calls it a war. Mm. We are at war and we're losing, and why are we losing?
And I can't...
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, like as you said, the kind of this war footing in it, I can't help, like it evokes, this winning the attitudes of hearts and minds. It evokes, methods of counterinsurgency, which have been developed and really honed since then. But it's sort of this narrative building around how to create narratives to bend public perception into their favour, to the capitalist favour.
Yeah, it was that. That's the kind of the umbrella. That's the overarching frame, I guess. But he was also very specific. How do we do that? How do we bend that narrative frame back in the favour of hyper capitalism to develop the kind of predator capitalism that we live under today? He had four basic prescriptions. One was build an intellectual cadre, take back the universities, create a career path for conservative intellectuals and start writing their own story and have that magnified and perpetuated through the academic world. The second was to take much tighter editorial control over the media channels that they owned and start fighting really aggressively for at least equal share in public media and, center-left outlets. His third prescription was be much more electorally active, which in the US involved effectively there were some experiments with the Libertarian Party and then they went full tilt on occupying the Republicans. And the fourth channel, the fourth arm, if you like, was to capture the judiciary. So start running these test cases through lower courts while also stacking the courts all the way to the US Supreme Court. And so gradually they've unraveled such democratic protections. And the United States was not a perfect society, and it won't surprise you to learn that it wasn't a socialist paradise in the 1960s and 70s. But there's been this extremely systematic campaign, which they knew would take decades. Though, people sometimes accuse capitalists of only caring about next quarterly results. No, this was very long term. They were building career paths and pipelines for people, and they knew that they were going to need to spend money and that they would be at it for a while.
Mm. Yeah, and look, the interesting thing, they say take back your judiciary, and Powell himself ended up on the Supreme Court of the United States. And
he did.
And he was got to be known as quite a liberal judge and a human rights judge, because he was good on things like gay rights and women's issues and desegregation and all those kind of thing. And it's sort of, in some ways, I guess this is not where we're going to go with the show, but it just struck me then that separating what's known as left politics as in liberal politics, all the different rights issues, from the hard economics of maintaining control of the country.
Yeah, I think it's a really good observation. He was considered a moderate at the time, but he also wrote the majority report on a couple of really important decisions that were effectively unbinding the rules of participation in elections. So a couple of very serious judgments that occurred on the US Supreme Court while he was on the bench effectively held that money should be considered as speech and corporations should be considered people. And that then offers them constitutional protections, which up until that point had really only formally applied to human beings. Suddenly they applied to, and this is well before the Citizens United decision, is obviously decades before, suddenly these massive corporations and pools of dark money were being offered constitutional protections to participate in elections, and that money was considered a form of protected speech. And that creates this incredibly warped electoral environment where now money buys elections, and everybody knows it's the case. We go through these performative rituals every couple of years, and we all, you know, and I've spent a bit of time in that domain, we work our hearts out. And the Australian context is obviously a bit different, but it's not going to surprise any of your listeners to know that money isn't incredibly tilts the electoral table. We're meant to get one vote per person, but that voting power is magnified by this enormous influence network that's been built, and it does buy elections.
And you're saying money is seen as speech.
That's under United States.
Yeah,
They even have a Bill of Rights there. We're not even really afforded those protections. But there these are decisions that were unfolding in the 70s and 80s, ran test cases through the US Supreme Court that effectively argued that money as an amplifier of free speech should be afforded protections under the First Amendment to the US Constitution. There's a fantastic podcast called The Lever by David Sirota, and they go through the Powell memorandum and what came after in quite a bit of detail. So we've channeled a bit of that into our work, and maybe it seems a little bit abstract to Australians. You know, we're struggling under different electoral law, different financial constraints, different kind of economy, a much simpler and less diversified economy in, you know, what Clinton Fernandez here calls a sub-imperial power. But we do have to pay attention to what has happened in the imperial core over the last few decades, because it intimately shapes the kind of work that we do here.
Yeah, most definitely. And I do want to talk about, you know, this next steps after what happened after the Powell memorandum, but also in terms of money influencing the vote or the electoral process, which we all know is true, but also thinking about who is sitting in government. You know, the Trump administration now has something like 9 billionaires in Congress. You know, there's like these massive amounts of wealth accumulated.
Massive amount of free speech, mate.
Oh, yes, of course. Sorry. Massive amounts of free speech that is actually taking up those chambers and Congress in the US, who of course, have only accumulated that wealth through the mechanisms that the Powell memorandum brought about in ensuring that that wealth could be accumulated.
Yeah, and before we move on to the local context, two things I want to point out. You just mentioned Clinton Fernandez and his work Sub-Imperial Power, and just a note to listeners that either next week or the week after, we're still working out a recording date, Clinton's going to be joining us here on a Friday Rave Saturday kick-on to talk about his latest book, Turbulence. But be that as it may, a shameless plug for Clinton and this show. I did mention Gerald Ford was involved with this whole thing to introduce this. What did old Jerry do?
Well, he was I mean, he was a bit of an interregnum president, wasn't he? Because he didn't expect, nobody elected him. He didn't expect to be the president, and he came about as a result of the kind of fatal rotting from the inside of the Nixon administration. But he was an important player in his own right, and he actually was in attendance, and this is really good investigative work by David Sirota and that team on that podcast at the Lever that I mentioned before. He actually was in attendance at one of the first meetings convened by the American Chamber of Commerce and Industry to put the Powell Memorandum into effect. He was their surprise guest. And a lot of there's no meeting minutes as such, but they do have the agendas and they do have the names of the committees, a lot of the attendees, and the general kind of shape of the conversations that took place. Because effectively what they did, they really threw it to fast forward the building of this huge influence network, which has its tentacles very, very deeply embedded here in Australia. We may feel peripheral to this, but we're not at all. And so, yes, a certain amount of that infrastructure was kind of, they fired the starting gun during the Ford administration.
Yeah, and how does that follow? Like, that was, the Ford administration was 50 years ago now. How is that, like, it started off, their organisation was the Federalists or something like that, where they first started talking.
Yeah, go ahead.
And they've now come through, and just take us through, if you can, a little bit, how that has morphed and developed into the plethora of think tanks and the rest of it that we're seeing now, which are also, you know, into the super PACs, what have become known as, but also active here in Australia.
Yeah, effectively they went into a full court press on all the things that Powell suggested. And if you remember, one of his domains, one of his areas where he figured they were really failing was in building an intellectual cadre, building intellectual infrastructure to seize narrative control of the economic conversation, but also wider debates around the shape of society, around how should education be funded, how should healthcare be funded. Are we just these kind of atomic particles bouncing around in the capitalist economy, or should there be social protections for human beings, for the environment? And so they borrowed the expertise of a fellow called Anthony Fisher from London, who'd set up what's arguably the world's first neoliberal think tank in London in 1954. And Fisher perfected the model, and he did spend a little bit of time in Australia, or at least in Sydney. Fisher had perfected the model of what was later described as a model where you get academics to say what business cannot say for itself. So you get academics to publish these very serious and high-minded sounding papers on subjects that might have been considered to be a bit dull or a bit specialist. Fisher was circulating them amongst academic departments, amongst news desks, and amongst the right wing of the Tory Party in the UK at the time, and gradually popularizing the ideas of neoliberalism, which is effectively to just say we're going to have total carnivore capitalism from now on. There's to be no constraints. We don't worry about monopolies. We don't worry about social protections for people. We don't worry about poverty. It's just going to be full octane capitalism here on out. And they couch it in all this language of freedom and liberty, but effectively what it is just real predator capitalism. And that's obviously where we live today to varying degrees in different parts of the world.
And, so, and Fisher started up the, what was it, the IEA, the Institute for Economic...
Institute of Economic Affairs. In London, yeah, in 54. And it set the template, it laid the groundwork for Margaret Thatcher's election, you know, decades later. And then they hopscotched the model out across the Atlantic, into the United States, and eventually into Canada, into Australia, and then... Fisher was involved in setting up the Centre for Independent Studies here in Sydney, but also some of the real foundational think tanks in the United States that were doing public policy founded by the oil and gas industry, by mining companies, chemical companies, banks, Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, later the American Enterprise Institute, and some of the ones that might be vaguely familiar from things like Project 2025 more recently.
And Project Esther.
Yeah.
Project Esther. So you can see a lot of the kind of foundational roots going down in the early 70s. And it's propped up with money from the Koch family and from these big dark money pools that are effectively taking, you know, there's nothing wrong with the idea of a think tank, of a policy shop where brainiacs, you know, and specialists are sitting down a little bit detached and a step removed from the political process coming up with ideas. They've kind of warped that model and mutated it into something where, you know, they call themselves research fellows and visiting fellows and all this kind of stuff, but actually they're just lobbyists. Mm. They're being paid to launder industry positions and the positions of oligarchs and make it sound as though it's a good thing for the public. And that's the working model, really.
And what, just back to Maggie Thatcher, what role did Anthony Fisher and the Institute for Economic Affairs have, if any, in Margaret Thatcher being elected?
They had such a significant role that there's correspondence between Thatcher and Hayek and Fisher where she basically says, you created the intellectual climate that made our victory possible.
Mm.
This is in 1979. And so Fisher had been at it since 54. He'd been at it for decades by then. There's all this correspondence back and forth where it's like, that really worked. So what you're doing is they're cultivating a big wing of the Tory party. They're placing these bullshit academic papers in the right-wing press. And they're popularizing the idea, you know, on radio, on emerging television channels. And they're effectively just warping the intellectual culture towards neoliberalism such that it creates the foundation for these, what turned out to be utterly toxic and harmful ideas. They're making it sound incredibly reasonable and rational.
Mm, and just, I guess, in the contemporary setting, seeing, like you mentioned before, words like freedom. And, you know, I think a big one, what we spoke about a few weeks ago on a Friday rave, was this idea of the homeland and the supplanting of not necessarily in intellectual settings, but within the public vernacular of bringing these terms as a disguise. I mean, the mention of homeland or of this idea of freedom, which we're currently seeing in the US, is pretty overtly fascistic.
Well, it's almost, they're just stopped short of saying fatherland uber alles, frankly, aren't they?
But I guess in a contemporary setting of seeing where that was at the time of Margaret Thatcher being elected to where we are now, and I guess where that leads to in how targeted and how polished these campaigns are.
They are, and they're only 1 or 2 degrees of separation from naked white supremacy, just from outright unapologetic white supremacy and fascist adjacent ideologies. But it's still dressed up in this kind of academic language. But if you can see what's happening at the moment, we're jumping forward across the continent in a few decades here. But the whole ecosystem of this Atlas Economic Research Foundation that Fisher eventually, in 1981, he founded that, and then they've proliferated literally nearly 600 of these things all over the world. The Australian arm of that network is busily cultivating One Nation. So they've hollowed out and kind of decapitated the moderate wing of the Liberal Party. They've hollowed that out completely, and they're busy moving across to One Nation. So there's no doubt at all that you scratch the surface of this thing and race politics is right there and has been from the very beginning.
And I guess, in you know, when we're seeing this idea of critical race theory in the US or cultural Marxism, which are these talking points from people like Andrew Bolt, of like where are these terms kind of coming from that are then proliferated intellectually, which is words, they are dressed up. And I think, you know, someone like Jordan Peterson for me comes to mind in kind of bringing these academic ideas, or what are seemingly academic ideas, to a population for really dangerous ends.
That's exactly right. I think we've seen a war unfold in a couple of phases, and the first phase of the war really starting in the 70s in Chile, and then in the UK, the United States, really across the Western world, was against centres of solidarity, which, and what that looked like, was going very hard against the trade union movement and attempted decapitation of union leadership wherever it was focused on, in particular, international solidarity or its alliances with the anti-war movement. The second phase, depending on how you read it, and I'm really oversimplifying here, was much more of a culture war than an economic war. So having really, I don't think they've fatally damaged global trade unionism, but it's certainly not in the shape that it was. You win that economic war and you kind of create that vacuum in the workplace that's obviously been taken up by the employers. And then, well, what's left is a culture war. And that's been used to divide us up against each other, in part through these mechanisms of ID politics. But it's also, it's a distraction and it's a way of targeting vulnerable people among us, distracting away from these very real material harms that are being done to us by these centres of power.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, we're seeing terms of, like, you know, especially now marching on the streets against mass immigration, and this focus away from a really downwardly mobile working class or, you know, upper middle class that are now turning towards this idea that it's mass immigration, which is a total fabrication.
Yeah, so who do you blame when the policies that you wrote down in the 1940s to say we're going to rip away everybody's social safety nets, we're going to destroy any centres of social protection and social cohesion in society, we're going to make, you know, a free market free for all and encourage monopolies that'll be able to price gouge people. When you successfully build that world, who are you going to point to avoid people from wheeling guillotines into the town square, as has been done in past moments of social struggle? You're probably going to point at immigrants. You're going to point at trans kids. You're going to point at people who can't defend themselves, and people who are already socially disadvantaged, to distract away from the harm that you've done.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned earlier, just briefly, the coup against Allende in Chile in 1973. So there's documented evidence of the CIA, and I believe the term that you referred to is that Milton Friedman's Chicago Boys jumped into action following the coup. And, I mean, obviously now we're seeing Maria Corina Machado in Venezuela being kind of pushed up and bolstered.
Oh, Nobel bloody Peace Prize, mate.
Yeah, exactly. And whilst, you know, some who... the influence there is promoting talking points that are part of the Atlas Network, and with Machado as a mouthpiece, whilst the US are simultaneously threatening all-out war, they're seizing oil tankers and oil assets in Venezuela. Could you draw some links or talk about, you know, what happened in 1973 in Chile and in comparison to what we're seeing in Venezuela now?
Yeah, unfortunately, it is history repeating itself. Never precisely, but it's right there. You don't really need to scratch it too deeply to see it. In 73, and certainly there's very strong written evidence that the CIA was involved in that the familiar pattern, I suppose, of Allende proposing to nationalize copper mines to, you know, create a much deeper and more workable social safety net for Chileans, nationalizing things, really brings the eye of Sauron into Chile in 73, and he's replaced by one of his top military generals. And of course, who do they fly in to restructure the economy, rewrite their constitution a few years later, is Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys. And so these are the economic theories that have been, you know, written up by this thing called the Mont Pelerin Society in the 1940s, which Friedman was a part of, and introduced at a national scale really for the very first time. And so what that looks like is these very wide and very deep attacks on civil society, on trade unions in particular, destruction of the social safety net, creation of enormous inequality. There's no more loose talk about nationalizing copper mines or other forms of infrastructure. And it creates this kind of hell of inequality in Chile that they still haven't been able to recover from. Mm. Fast forward now to Venezuela. After that incredibly corrupt Nobel Peace Prize announcement, Machado was on the homepage of the Atlas Network. Mm. You know, they're popping champagne corks there because she's one of theirs. It's the same, you know, the same infrastructure, the same ideology, just being rolled forward a few decades, and an attempt at a soft or potentially, if necessary, violent regime change. In Venezuela again. This is not the first time that these people have attempted this. We'll be back.
Radio 3CR. It's Saturday morning, and maybe you've tuned in for Palestine Remembered. They're on a summer break, and Mercedes and I, Jacob, from A Friday Rave, are filling in their time slot for summer programming, and we're joined by Scott Ludlam to talk about the powers that be that influence public policy. Scott, just jumping forward a little bit, brother. I noticed, I couldn't help but notice a wry smile come across my face when you referred to these people as the Eye of Sauron, looking at the world, and that brought me forward to Peter Thiel.
Oh, wow.
Well, and I say that because Sauron is, of course, a reference from The Lord of the Rings, and his companies, Valar Ventures, Palantir, Andural, the Nayar, they're all, he tends to name his Mithril Capital, there's another one. He tends to name his companies from The Lord of the Rings as well. But Peter Thiel also was a guest speaker at Atlas Institute a couple of years back in California.
It's just difficult to tell whether he's read the books. It was a horrific and corrupting mass surveillance device. The Palantir was not something you could touch without, you know, causing enormous harm to yourself and to others.
Yeah, anyway, but then did George Pell read the Bible for that matter?
Well, now we're heading down a rabbit hole. But yeah, it's really interesting that you mention these guys because they're genuinely terrifying. They wield enormous amounts of capital and surveillance power. They're very deeply enmeshed in increasingly the authoritarian shift of various governments around the world.
Mm.
But it is also, it's an example of how the network is not, it's not singular and it's certainly not monolithic. It's a very strange coalition of Christian Zionists, technocrats, people who believe in nothing but capital. You know, some of it's extremely ideological, some of it is utterly cold. It's a coalition that shouldn't necessarily be able to hold together, but there it is. I guess it's just worth pointing out at this point, if people aren't, you know, completely depressed at the scale of this thing, is that it is very factionalized. It's not a singular or monolithic structure. There's people, they have disagreements. When Trump took over the Republican Party, that caused, you know, enormous ructions inside the network as to whether we were, you know, Reagan conservatives or whatever flavor Trump and his people have brought to this thing. So it's worth, I guess, noting and at this point maybe reminding people there's a really very adept research gone into this stuff because it's not, you know, and I'm probably guilty of this as anybody, you can kind of caricature these guys as the Eye of Sauron or these kind of cartoon villains. A lot of them, they're just regular people. And it's worth reading Dr. Jeremy Walker of UTS, who's done a lot of the primary research into the evolution of the network and the shape of it here in Australia. And also Lucy Hamilton, who does really exceptional work. She's got a Substack and is researching the shape of these networks and the individuals who pop up again and again. Just to get a sense of the shape of the network, how it's changed and evolved over time, and what its weak points are. I don't know if we have enough time this morning to go into it in detail, but these guys are not all seeing, they're not all powerful, they're not omnipotent, they screw up all the time. This is the network that brought us Peter Dutton's big nuclear pivot, which was an absolute faceplant, like politically as you know, an act of enormous political self-harm. So, you know, it's people like Tony Abbott and Peter Credlin crouching there behind the scenes who are not brilliant. They're mendacious, they're cunning. They've got a lot of resources and a lot of, you know, very powerful network, but they're not always very good at what they do, which is, I guess, fortunate for the rest of us.
Yeah. Scott, you know, you just mentioned Jeremy Walker and Lucy Hamilton there. I just want to give a quick shout out. Jeremy Walker actually was on the Climate Action Show here on 3CR, and Lucy Hamilton is a regular guest on Yeah Nah Pasaran, also here on 3CR. So definitely suggest anyone who's tuning in to go to the 3CR website if you want to know more about this stuff right here at our little radio station.
Jeremy's great. I mean, they're both fantastic, and there are a bunch of very good writers and people who are following this stuff closely. Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Aron are two. Anthony Klan is one who's done a lot of the really forensic work on how this thing is financially structured. So there's there are people who are really paying attention. Jeremy, I single out a fair bit because he's very wide in scope, and his focus, a lot of it, is the fact that really since the beginning, it's been the oil and gas industry that's been funding a lot of this stuff. They're the reason that we're in a climate emergency, is that in the 80s and 90s, when there were genuine global diplomatic and scientific and engineering attempts to move us away from fossil fuels, they ran this, they used this infrastructure that had been built by the tobacco industry and by their forebears in the oil and gas industry in the early 20th century. They used it to run this global disinfo campaign, which has, you know, potentially pushed us past the point of no return into very serious and dangerous climate breakdown. Using these think tanks, using these media arms and these PR companies. Jeremy's work is second to none on that. That really pinpoints the nature of the crime that we're in the middle of.
And I guess where we are in the contemporary, you know, where we are now in terms of using disinformation campaigns, I mean, we've sort of seen the emptying out of what truth is, what, you know, really, really targeted campaigns to kind of quell any discussion, particularly over the last 2 years with Israeli Hasbara, of warping narratives, not just in this instance, but for a long time. But I guess thinking about where we are now with AI and the potential for that disinformation, to now we're in a situation where people are finding it difficult to ascertain what whether what they're looking at is real or not, which is sort of a next iteration, I guess, of these earlier disinformation campaigns.
It is. So Trump's strategist, Trump administration Mark One, Steve Bannon, called it flooding the zone with shit. You just throw enough shit at the wall. There's an amazing Hannah Arendt quote, which I won't attempt to recreate out of my brain because I'll mangle it, but she points out much the same thing, that the purpose of modern propaganda isn't necessarily to persuade. Disinfo's purpose in our age, and she clocked it in the 1970s, is actually to disorient and to unmoor people from consensus reality altogether. Yeah. And I think maybe consensus reality's always been overrated. It's always, you know, it's not a stable concept, but the idea that you've got these very powerful and really quite skilled communications professionals, really from the 1920s on in the Western world, figuring out how to unmoor people from consensus reality in order to sell them soap and cigarettes.
Yep.
And now it's being done in order to sell us regime change and, you know, to ignore the fact that climate change has been knowingly done by these enormous petrochemical companies and coal companies. It's kind of scary, and even though the techniques have changed over time, the basic purpose haven't. So, yes, now there is AI that is increasingly making it difficult to tell whether what you're looking at has been manufactured or recorded on a camera. But the purpose behind a lot of this stuff is it was written down in a book called Propaganda by Edward Bernays in the 1930s.
Yeah.
Some of this stuff has got very, very long lead time on it.
And one of the things that's become somewhat of a mantra of a Friday rave is that there is one goal and one goal only of global capital, and that's to continue accumulating more and more of the wealth and resources into fewer and fewer hands or fewer and fewer bank accounts.
Yeah, well, that's that old adage, is to follow the money, try and figure out who benefits from these things. And the, you know, the blunt answer to a lot of that is, well, who benefits from a tax on renewable energies, made up bullshit about whales being harmed by wind turbines? Who benefited from the pro-nuclear push? Who benefits from this disinformation torrent? Is the oil and gas industry and the coal industry. And if you scratch the surface of the, you know, crappy memes on Facebook and stuff that's circulating out there, you see it emerging from the oil and gas majors through these pools of dark money and into these foundations and out the other side into this archipelago of different think tanks and influence organisations.
Yeah, and as you're aware, Mercedes and I often do a lot more research into the military companies than we do the oil and gas companies. But be that as it may, it's the oil is still the number one resource. That is what they're after, and the military are just really ways of keeping the oil flowing. So it does come back to the oil and the gas.
And
a lot of it does.
And also I'm just thinking now in terms of critical minerals of how much we're going to see, I guess, the push of these networks into normalising critical minerals. And I think that what we've seen, we've spoken about on the show before, but that always critical minerals exploration and extraction in Australia has been focused around renewable energy. But now that's really quite overtly looking at for national security. And I'm curious to see where that juncture lies.
There's not a great deal of difference between, a violent coup in Venezuela for oil or a violent coup in Bolivia for lithium.
Mm.
You can see the shape of it is reasonably familiar from decades past.
Yeah.
And I think it was you guys who pointed it out last time we spoke, the sense of which the critical minerals have been pitched very much as it's pretty cuddly stuff. It's for wind turbines, it's for solar cells, it's for the batteries in your flash new electric car. They also have very important strategic military applications, as you guys have pointed out. And I think we've got to keep that really front and center in mind and not be, not allow ourselves to be distracted by, I guess it's okay if there's a lithium coup in Bolivia because, I want an electric car. And that's not what's going on here at all.
And it goes further. Now, we've done a show and we've done some work recently with Aunty Sue Hazeldine from Ceduna about satellite launches by Southern Launch from Whalers Way and Cunyibba launch bases. And they're talking about the satellites need to do the work on the satellites because working in zero gravity is the only way they can produce drugs for drug research to help beat cancer, basically, and ease people's suffering, as if they couldn't ease a lot more people's suffering just by building a bloody hospital. But then, the real work of zero gravity on satellites is to create wafer-thin semiconductors that can't happen on Earth but need to be happening in zero gravity. So it's always the way they spin it as something which is supposed to be for the betterment of humanity, so that when you oppose it, it's like when we oppose satellite launches, don't you want to cure cancer?
Well, somewhere, somebody in one of these think tanks got paid a lot of money to make it about kids with cancer.
We're on the wrong side, brother.
I'm not sure that's true.
Yeah, where we are now of where this network and where it's operating in Australia is that I feel like we haven't really spoken a whole heap about the domestic situation.
Yeah, we can kind of run that in fast forward, but again, I'd point that to some of the very talented writers and researchers who are covering this stuff in more detail than we've got time for here. Is effectively since the 40s, really since the IPA, probably another friend of the station, was set up in Melbourne in 1943. We've had these things. That was set up by the mining industry, by Rupert Murdoch's dad, and by a bunch of other monopolists to dress up industry lobbying points as public policy. So that the model got set up during the Second World War, before most people listening were even alive, right?
Yeah.
So we're fairly familiar with this, and now there's a couple of dozen of these things operating. Five or six of them are formal, including the IPA, are formal affiliates of the Atlas Network in Washington, D.C., where you've got kind of hub 30 or 40 of these big institutions in Washington. They're not necessarily funding the Australian arm, but they do a lot of ideas exchange, of personnel exchange. There's a unit in Western Australia that does a lot of secondments and placements and training for young people who want to go into this network. Mm. So if you want to know what it looks like in real time, it was Advance, which is not, as far as we know, a formal Atlas affiliate, but it was set up by a bunch of people who are running the Voice to Parliament referendum no campaign or campaigns. They recognised very early on that it was a three-cornered contest, and they They ran the No campaign from the progressive side, ripping off Robbie Thorpe's and Celeste Little, you know, what they were saying, that this thing was a you know, a feeble shadow of what a sovereign people should demand. They had a pop-up group running those arguments while they had, on the other side, four or five different pop-up groups running diametrically opposite arguments, that it was the voice of division and some really out-and-out racist shit. And it crashed the voice to Parliament proposal, crashed it from left and the right, or the, you know, progressive no and the regressive no.
Yeah.
That was one example, I suppose. Whatever you thought of the referendum, of the network's many heads, many tentacles flooding the zone with shit, very, very successfully. They've tried again at multiple times, never with quite that degree of success. Their electoral campaign efforts are uneven at best. But the big pro-nuclear push we saw in 2024-25, mm-hmm. that was their effort as well. It's just slightly different configuration of groups, but a lot of the same familiar names and faces and money right in the middle of it. Totally face-planted Peter Dutton's attempt at winning the prime ministership. So the network's a bit bruised. It's spent the last 6 months kind of hollowing out the Liberal Party and cozying up to One Nation. But it's really worth, I suppose, looking at its different manifestations and the different campaigns that it's run over time, and to not get too snookered or too rabbit holey on the extreme fringe end, because what this thing does is it shifts the whole Overton window.
Mm.
It shifts the whole political culture, gets tilted to the right. When you've got this amount of energy being pushed into the extreme right, it obliterates the moderate wing of the Liberal Party, drags Labour from the centre through into the right. Until now, the moderate Labour position on climate change is we just need to open up all the coal and gas because this is all the transition.
Mm.
You know, this weird bullshit arguments about net zero. What it does to the centre, if you like, is it completely warps it.
Mm.
So Labour, you know, senior Labour people have a quite an adversarial relationship, for example, with Atlas's various extrusions and units. But the Labour position on climate or on AUKUS or a whole bunch of ideas where we actually could really do with a bit of a centre-left mainstream political presence at the moment, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist. And also putting all that energy into One Nation, which is now cozying up further and further and closer, which it always has, to the far right, but now we're seeing that impact on the streets in overt fascist marching, leading marches in Australia, and kind of every other fortnight, really, pushing this anti-immigration sentiment upon which One Nation is pushing its platform.
Yeah. And because they borrow most of their ideas from the United States, it's worth understanding how, you know, you can successfully counterattack this thing. And we can see, because they're so derivative and many of them haven't had an original idea in as long as I've been active, they borrow. It's an entirely derivative set of political strategies that's just ripped off from elsewhere. So we can really learn from that. And it can be successfully fought and has been here and elsewhere, everywhere from Brazil, you know, there's a huge surge of support for the Greens with Zach Polanski in the UK. You can critique Mamdani's campaign in New York, but nonetheless, it brought a fresh fire, I suppose, to just confronting this thing, not being apologetic or trying to sidestep it, but really challenge it and go after it. And I think we've got to figure out here, what shape does that look like locally? Not borrowing shit from elsewhere, but what does that look like when it's done from this ground and from this country, and not be bullied by these people anymore?
Yeah, well, I think one of the first things you do, and that's what you're doing here, and just about time for us to wrap up, but one of the things we need to do is let people know who these people are. You know, when we're talking about climate change, when we're talking about net zero, when we're talking about the Liberal Party disintegrating so far up their own arses that the Labor Party has to take their position, that their position on the right, that these are the people who are set up and financed by the extraction industries, And when we're talking about satellites, 14,000 satellites or something there are up there now, just as an example. You know, these are the, you know, Peter Thiel owns the companies that run the satellites. Peter Thiel is, you know, lauded by these people. I don't harp on about him too much. But
we do enough already.
We do enough already. And now, just by the way, they're running so many services for the Australian military and the Australian government and wants to set up a company to genetically modify embryos in uterus to create a master race and, even more terrifying, a slave race.
Are we going to need another 40 minutes? You throw us down this tangent.
No, I'm just saying we just need to sow. Well, what I want to do is throw the people down that tangent. So when you hear these things, these are the people behind it, the people we've been talking about, the people you've been talking about, who are not necessarily the people who are front and centre of the campaigns, but the people who are financing them.
Yeah, because the whole purpose of the network is to obscure the source of financing to make it difficult to tell and to kind of launder the money through these series of different organizations that come and go and pop up. And you know, some of them have been there for decades. Some of them have been around for 5 minutes. Some of them are well-resourced. Some of them are just a guy with a Facebook page. That's why I think it is, and you guys are doing such a public service here. It's a bit daunting when you first get into it, but it's really worth just have a bit of a mental map. These are the structures that industry uses to get academics to say what they can't say for themselves, to kind of launder these ideas into the public debate, get a sense of who they are and who's paying the bills, and then figure out the old-fashioned way, and including some new stuff, how we can test it and challenge it, as we've always done.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's about all we've got time for. And some of the names and the articles and research that have been mentioned on today's program, we'll be sure to pop the links to in our little write-up. So the podcast for Saturday Kick-Ons will be going up on the Friday Rave page on 3CR.
Yeah, and we're going to revisit this over and over again. So if you miss some of these names, they're not the last time you're going to hear them on a Friday Rave.
Or Saturday Kick-Ons.
Support your community radio station, because you're not necessarily going to hear these conversations in other places. So thanks you folks as well for what you're doing.
No, thank you. That was Scott Ludlam, independent activist, joining us for the Friday Rave Saturday Kick-On, talking about the people behind the moves that coerce, bend governments to their will.
Big thanks to Scott for joining us, and we will be back next Saturday.
Next Saturday, hopefully with Clinton Fernandez. If not, he'll be the Saturday after that.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.